Thank you, Bob, and good evening, everyone. It's certainly a pleasure to be here. By the way, Bob, I'm a biologist, not a physicist. Just for the record. Presently, I work in the disease vector control industry as a biologist. Terry Phillips and I work together. And basically, I spend my time devising and promoting more environmentally friendly ways to prevent disease, to kill insects that carry disease, that sort of thing. There are always better ways to do things, and that's mostly what I spend my time doing. My experience has been in ecology, biology, chemistry, hazardous materials, and instrumentation, electronic instrumentation used in the process control industry. So you might say I'm definitely a generalist when it comes to that. My academic background was in ecology, split pretty much evenly between biology and chemistry. So I have a wide variety of experiences in industry over the last, more years than I care to recall. Let's put it that way. I always hesitate to tell people I'm a generalist because this thing with generalists and specialists always gets tends to be a hang-up. You know, the specialist is a person who learns more and more about less and less until he knows, obviously, you know, everything about nothing. And the generalist, unfortunately, is the opposite. You know, he learns less and less about more and more until he knows nothing about everything. So but we both end up at the same place. We really do. And as you age and you find that job changes and that kind of thing become more difficult, it's really driven home. We all end up at the same place anyway. In addition to my work here, that is at Beacon of Systems in this area, I also run the evangelism outreach campaign for the church that I belong to, Holy Trinity Lutheran in Abington, which is an organized telemarketing kind of thing we do, which we may get into at some point if we have time, either at this meeting or another. Excellent opportunity for Christians to get the word of God out there. The other thing I do is I run the Lyme disease support group in this end of the state, which also meets at that church. The church doesn't sponsor it. We meet there because they give us a free roof over our heads, and you can't beat that. So that's why we meet there. So what I want to do tonight is talk about God, science, and creation. I mean creation, a noun, not creation, a verb. By God's creation, I mean everything we see about us, the universe. And I want to tie that, my own experiences and views on those kinds of things, to this problem of Lyme disease as an example. In other words, use Lyme disease as a window to look at these other elements and get a handle on what I see as happening and what has happened over the last 30 years or so. In fact, let's start out with Lyme disease just for a minute. This is an infectious disease that is transmitted, we think, usually by disease vectors like ticks and flies and mosquitoes, that kind of thing. It can also be transmitted by body fluids, you know, urine and sputum, that blood, definitely through blood transfusions. And it drives me crazy that no one is doing much to stop it. And that's when I get into creation, God's creation and science, and that sort of thing, it's what I want to look at. Why is that not happening? Why is it that we have a disease that's preventable and yet no one is bothering to prevent it, basically? Which is a crime, because this is a disastrous disease for many, many people. In the state of Pennsylvania, there are about 4,000 CDC-defined cases. By that, I mean cases as defined by the Centers for Disease Control, which is a very, very strict definition, because all they're looking for is whether cases are increasing or decreasing in number. So it's a very, very strict kind of definition. So Pennsylvania has about 4,000. The actual number is probably about 10 times that. And many of these people are permanently disabled at this point. And I don't need any more people in the support group, you know? So I take every opportunity I can to talk about Lyme disease, how it can be prevented, and give people a bit of information. And I have a series of slides we'll blitz through at the end of my talk here, so at least you know what a deer tick looks like, what these spirochetes look like, and what kinds of symptoms to look for in this disease. Why is nothing happening? You know, why is it not being prevented? First of all, we have an unknowing, unlistening medical establishment, basically. The nature of American medicine almost enforces that kind of setting, in which doctors really don't have time to listen to patients, don't have time to learn about new diseases coming down the pike, or if they did, they'd be out of business. We have that kind of problem. We also have the fact that elected officials prefer to do nothing because if they do something, they might be blamed for it and voted out of office. You have that kind of problem, which is a very serious one. We have the public and disease vector control workers who have been doing the same thing for the last 25 years and don't want to change that. They want to keep doing the same thing. Besides, they have a fixed budget. And if they're asked to do something new, where are they going to get the money? So, you've got that kind of problem. In addition, in many parts of the country, and we happen to live in one of them, there is no tradition of protecting people from disease. We really don't have those kinds of traditions here because we've never had serious problems within, what, probably since the turn of the century. When was the last case of yellow fever in Philadelphia? My guess would be around 1900, somewhere around there. As a child, I remember one man I knew who did have yellow fever and contracted it in the Philadelphia areas. He may have been the last case, I don't know. So we don't have the traditions of protecting ourselves from disease here, infectious diseases. And finally, we have a mentality which has developed over my lifetime, which values plants and animals more than people. That's a simple fact. In our society, that is a fact. I think that's sad. So our official response to this disease is more one of lethargy than conspiracy. You know, it's something that's just happened and nobody's doing anything about it. And we will get back to that. As an observer of the human condition, as I think Mark Twain described himself one time, I'm appalled by all of this. I like to stand back and watch people, as Perry knows well, and see how things are happening and why they're happening. So as an observer, I personally am appalled by all of this problem that's really unnecessary. So what I want to do is look at the last 30 years, 35 years, and my observations as to what has happened to bring Americans and us, you know, both believers and non-believers, to the state that we're in. Because our situations are not really different in terms of our points of view of society, ourselves, disease, that kind of thing. We have definitely gone from a people who were very upbeat. Those of you who remember the 50s, the biggest thing in the 50s, often in the newspaper, was the fact that President Eisenhower had a hole-in-one when he was playing golf. I mean, many of you, you know, looking at you, I know many of you remember those days. That was the biggest thing to happen. Now, I know this is incredible to people who don't recall those years, but that was a fact. I mean, once the Korean War was over, I guess in '52, that was the most important thing that was happening all too often. By the way, let me point out, as I'm talking, I would actually prefer that you ask me questions, interrupt, contradict, throw rocks, whatever. It's much more interesting for me if you do that. Yes?
Would it be possible that things were happening, but they weren't reported as they are today?
Oh, sure. Racism, for instance, is a good example. Absolutely. Yes. But to those of us in the middle class who are growing up in communities filled with, you know, engineers and maybe lawyers and doctors and people like that, and maybe upper blue-collar workers, we never even heard about those things. You know, to us, everything was fine. And actually, those are very unusual years in that, you know, women housewives normally did not have to work during those years. If you went back 30 years before that, that was not true. Women did have to work. And today, once again, women have to work. As kids, we grew up expecting. We had a positive attitude. We grew up expecting to go to college, to get a good job, to marry a beautiful woman, have wonderful kids who always behaved. You know, these are all the things that we expected. It was a very positive, upbeat time. It really was. I mean, in spite of the fact that we just came through the Korean War, that's simply how we were. So what has happened since? You know, and the answer is a great deal. And first and foremost, I think, is the Vietnam War. Those were dreadful times. I remember being in ROTC in, I guess it was 1961, and applying for the advanced program. And at that time, we were questioned about geography. And none of us could understand why they were questioning us about Southeast Asia. I mean, we had never even heard of Vietnam and Laos and Thailand and these places before. And it wasn't too many years later that I realized why the Army was asking us all these questions as prospective officers about these areas. You know, they knew what was going on, and we, the general population, did not. So you're exactly right. There are lots of things that were not reported. And that was one of them. We were already at war, but the U.S. didn't know it. So we had this Vietnam War going on. It did not have a well-defined purpose. In fact, we were lied to about why we fought it. Those of you remember, again, the Gulf of Tonkin, the resolution. We thought that the North Vietnamese were firing upon our ships. It turned out that was a lie. And within a year or two after we got into the war, we knew it was a lie. And that kind of thing went on and on. We had the demoralization resulting from the fact that we were fighting a war which we started to suspect was wrong. You know, we shouldn't have been fighting it in the first place. That was very demoralizing for the U.S. population. There was a lot of bitterness at home between different factions. We had the pro-war people, which was usually administration people or elected officials who had to support what we were doing. And then you had the younger people, typically, who were rejecting this war that we were involved in. So we had domestic spying. Those of you who worked for major universities during that time may well remember the fact that your telephone conversations were tape recorded. And this was the CIA doing this within the United States, which was illegal, but it was happening. So we had all these things going on with respect to the Vietnam War. Another thing that happened in that 30-year period was environmental problems became obvious. You know, my basic training is as an ecologist, although I don't really work at that field. And, of course, almost nobody works at the field they were trained for by the time, you know. That's simply a sad fact. You know. We go to college. I went to school for 22 years, you know. I worked as a consulting biologist before I got the advanced degree, but after I did get the advanced degree, I never again worked in that field. And that's typical from my experience. But I remember I think it was summer of 1964, Philadelphia had smog. Now, you have no idea what shock that was. I mean, we knew that Californians had smog, but that was explainable. I mean, they were crazy. I mean, everybody knew the Californians were crazy and probably a little bit evil to have smog. You must have been morally inferior or evil, you know, to have smog. And yet here it was on the East Coast. It was here too, see? So these were shocks. These were things that were happening, and nobody had thought about this kind of thing happening before. We started to have problems with certain chemicals. You know, pesticides and things like that were becoming a problem. Since 1950, the U.S. has produced and marketed over 70,000 different chemicals. From 1950 till today, about 70,000 different chemicals have come onto the marketplace. And each of us in our houses probably had between 100 and 1,000 of those in products. Not pure, but in, you know, as products, things that are built into products that we buy. There were some unpleasant surprises in a lot of those products that came into the market, you know. Our bubble was being burst. You know, in the 50s, we had this very positive outlook. And then when all of these things happened, things were suddenly not so rosy anymore. So we by today, have become a group of people who no longer think we can do things. We suspect, we think, sometimes we're even sure, we can't do anything right. This kind of attitude has overcome us. And for those of you who are young and think that this is the way it's always been, that's not so. We were at one time very positive people in the 50s, no question about that. Not at all. There's one other thing that has happened that I think it might, in the long run, be the most disastrous for us as a people and has generated this kind of negative attitude, and that is our school, our systems of school, education, especially with respect to technical things, math, science. I remember during the Vietnam years when I worked at the University of Pittsburgh in administration eventually. There were so many students coming into the school trying to escape the draft or because they didn't know what else to do, who wanted to go into education to become teachers. And it was a standing joke that if the student couldn't do anything else, they could always become a teacher. And unfortunately, all too often it was true. These were people who, you know, hated math, they hated science, felt that they were terrible at it. And they became teachers. Well, these are now our middle-aged teachers in our schools throughout the United States. I know there was a survey done, or a study done, I think it was about 10 years ago, I think it was high school math teachers. No, it was high school science teachers. I think it was 60% of them couldn't pass. It was either fifth or sixth grade math test. And these were our science teachers. You know, and these people are still out there in our schools. So this kind of thing has generated an anti-science, anti-knowledge feeling. Kids pick up on that very quickly. Yes?
The thing that you haven't mentioned yet that I was part of was the whole Eastern religious influence, the whole hippie movement, the alternative consciousness.
I personally was not involved in that. In fact, you want to take 2 minutes and say something about it?
Well,
really?
It's just an incredible influence on society. All the advertisements and things that happened in the 80s, late 70s, and 80s come out of that culture. Mm-hmm. All the ways of thinking about freedom, sexual freedom, and a non-rational thinking, you know, self being able to be the arbitrator of truth rather than the community. That's all coming from that whole influence of the, it started with many things, the drugs. The drugs was a big culture. And
right.
Things just kind of seeped into the culture. I remember a time before marijuana, before LSD became a big deal, how things were, and then after they came in, and how that just filtered into all the consciousness of a lot of things. So, and then the Eastern religion again has a big influence. The New Age movement.
I agree 100%. Yes.
I think that goes back to what you said about the Vietnam War, the rebellion.
Yes.
Rebellion,
oh, yes. Right.
The whole thing was that something was wrong with middle class
right.
America.
Right.
Real hatred of normal life. You know,
right.
Being productive.
It was an opportunity to slap society in the face.
Yeah.
Really.
A lot of those people eventually got into the system. but they
yes.
an attitude of disrespect. And what was really lost to me was the sense of community. The country became even more fragmented. I mean, it always was racism.
Sure.
It always was that, but there always was a sense that there's a common reality that has to affect all of us.
Right.
And with this Eastern mysticism coming in, all of a sudden everybody became a law to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody was anybody's neighbor.
Right. I think we believed in the melting pot until Vietnam. I mean, the melting pot was a fiction anyway, at least to some extent. But I think we believed in it. At least white middle class did until that time. You're right. Right.
Just one last thought.
Sure.
That the individual is not the primary focus, but the community was. That there was a sense of needing to contribute to the community. Even though, of course, they had selfishness like any other time in history. But at least what was taught or what was perceived was that there was a community that were responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
Now you don't have that. I mean, you have it. I'm sure you have it somewhere, different places, but it's not the general thing that's put out in the media or in the schools. Or
right.
The only place I see it is within the church that I belong to tell you the truth, at least in the part of society that I move in. It's the only place I see a sense of community, a sense of purpose, a sense, you know, in this case, outreach, bringing people to Jesus Christ, doing good as a witness, say, that kind of thing, which we've lost. There's no question. If you look at the costs for volunteer organizations today, they're horrendous. And the reason is volunteerism is dead. Volunteers are an endangered species, you know. They're almost extinct. No question about that. Good. So, people today, I think, know less about what they ought to know to survive in society than ever before in the history of mankind. You know, do you see what I mean by that? In other words, there's so much to know today. To be successful, whatever that is. You know, the law, chemistry, biology, physics, there's just so many things. Nutrition, medicine, so many things we have to know. Percentage-wise, I think people today know less than ever before in history. It's nobody objects to that? That's interesting. I say this many times when I do Lyme disease talks, when I do environmental talks. Nobody's ever objected to that, which surprises me. It's as though we all assume that is the case today. And I think it is true. Life indeed is very complex. my point is, at a time when we ought to know more, in fact, we are less literate and we are less aware technically of what's going on around us than we were perhaps, let's say, two generations ago. And that's a tragedy. As a nation, as a people, I'm sure it's one reason that vis-a-vis a number of Oriental countries, we're falling way behind. We don't have our act together. We don't know what we're doing, see? And I think, in large part, that's the reason. We've lost our sense of purpose, and we've lost our technical capability. Yes?
I think what you talk to teachers, too, the TV has taken over, and, you know, it rules young people's lives, and they're not reading, they're not thinking, and they're not interacting with their peers, and they're just sitting in front of public television.
Exactly. I very rarely see television. I mean, you can probably count on one hand the number of times I've watched television in a year. You know, fingers on one hand. But every once in a while, I will purposely look at something just to see what is on it. And it's absolutely appalling. Absolutely appalling. Many years ago, there was a book, I think, called it something to the effect of The Great American Wasteland, describing television. I think it was in the 50s. It hasn't changed. It's still a wasteland. In fact, it's worse. It is actually worse. Okay, so I think this is why we have got to the state we're in as a nation, as a people. All these negative things that have happened, and we've ended up with this negative attitude of ourselves. We are in a situation where we don't want to do anything, feel that we can't, and in fact, we don't do a lot to correct the problems that we could. Yes?
Is this the reason why Clinton is so popular? Because he appears to be someone who's really into changing things.
Probably.
And he's upbeat.
Right, right. I mean, in that sense, he's a Kennedy.
A lot of people sense that, you know, he's got to be something different.
Right, right. If you remember the presidency of John F. Kennedy, those were very exciting times. You know, I didn't especially care for the guy. But there was a tremendous sense of change that you know, so much was going to happen.
I think that was another impression of the country.
Yeah, oh, yes, definitely. When he was shot, that was an absolute disaster emotionally. I can remember that almost everybody remembers where they were at the time they heard that. And I can remember everybody just put down what they were doing and got up and walked out and went home. Nothing was said. We just got up and walked out and went home. It was a very terrible shock that kind of thing could happen here. One thing that bothers me about all this is that all too often it seems to me that believers have bought into this mentality. And I don't understand that. I really don't. Maybe somebody here could shed some light into why that, at least it seems to me, has happened all too often. I think of churches that I knew and went to, let's say, 30 or 35 years ago, which were very vibrant and very alive. Today, they're dead. You know, spiritually, they're dead. Why has that happened? And as I look at the people who are there now, it seems to me they have bought into this non-productive, we can't accomplish anything. There's no point in witnessing because people won't believe. There's no point in outreach and trying to help, you know, AIDS or whatever, because it doesn't make any difference. There seems to be a lot of that. Yes?
I think one of the problems is being able to think for oneself. I know I taught at the college level for many years, and I finally gave up on the basis of the inability of the student to really think, why are you studying this? Well, my father thinks this would be good for me. Well, this is where I think there's more money. Not because I'm really interested in engineering or I'm really interested in biology, but it's something for me to do, and none of them rarely ever go back to work in that particular field at all. I mean, they'll study it, they'll get a degree, an undergraduate degree, and go out and get a job selling some commodity or whatever the case may be, but certainly not in the field. But there was no ability to really think upon their own. I think that happens in the church. I mean, it gets into a social aspect.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
And they can't really sit down and think, what is this all about? Do I really believe? Do I accept Christ as my Savior? Do I or don't I? Well, somebody told me I did, so I guess I do. They're not really sure. And I know you witness to a lot of them. I happen to, in the church we go to, I'm in the reception room, and you have people come in after church. And the questions they ask are basic, fundamental. I mean, not anything where you can really, and when you start talking about something that was deeper, they get lost. And then you have to sit down with them for an hour or so and take them right through and
start from the beginning.
Because they just, I think the elementary schools are really the problem. Back there, not taught to think, they're taught by rote. And I know when I was teaching, one of the courses I had was in engineering. And they say, when you do this problem, what do? Multiply or divide first? And I said, I don't have the vaguest idea. And they said, well, you're teaching a course, you should know. And I said, well, it depends on a lot of things. What am I given? What do I have to find? And all, they didn't bother with that. They were taught at one time on a problem where you have temperature and pressure, you divide first, automatically. Or you automatically multiply, whatever the case may be. So I got so despairing that I finally gave up and went into industry.
I got out too, but for different reasons. Although they hinge on much the same thing. Much the same thing. I went into administration for a few years. What am I calling science? That's a question I have to ask myself. And Perry and I knock this about occasionally. And I think the best thing I could, best definition I can come up with is really very simple, a very simple one. And that is, what I call science is what we simply call natural law. I should say, the study of how God does things. To me, that is science. You know, looking at the material things, as opposed to spiritual. And looking at how God goes about doing things. Not why, but how. Many scientists, when you talk to them, don't understand the difference between how and why until you push their backs to the wall. You can ask a scientist a why question, and they'll give you a how. And you can play a game with them, actually. It can be kind of fun, where you keep asking why questions, and they'll keep giving you how answers. And then suddenly they catch on and realize that we're at a level above what they're talking about. And then, of course, they bail out, get angry, and walk away because real scientists don't ask why. you run into that kind of mentality a lot. But to me, science is simply looking at how God does things. And that's why I can deal with evolution and all these other concepts. I have no trouble at all because I give my own definition. I have no trouble at all with that kind of thing. When I think about how God does things, it seems to be miracles as opposed to the way things usually happen when we're watching them. Looking at the difference between those is very instructive. And when I think about that and look at it and look at the Bible, I realize that a miracle really is not that different from the way God does things every day. No, it's just that we don't know the rules he's using that time. See? I hope, and we've talked about this before too, I hope someday, you know, in heaven, I get a chance to see what rules God was using when he did whatever, you know, the water to wine at Cana or whatever. I hope we get a chance to do that. And then when this earth passes away and everything changes again, I hope we get a chance to study the new ways that things are done too. That's simply because I like to keep learning. So science and miracles and how things happen every day are very much tied together to me. I really don't distinguish from them, between them, and I don't think the Bible does either, really. Miracles, you know, if you look at chronologically at miracles, what do we see? We see creation, I think, has to be number one as a period in which miracles were occurring. And then you only have a few other periods after that when you see much in the way of miracles happening. You see during the Exodus with Moses, you see a whole series of miracles coming out, happening because God was demanding that he was one God. You know, I had to make this point to get people's attention. We had these series of miracles going on, right? Then we had Elijah and Elisha, that period of time when the worship of the one true God was really in serious trouble. And again, you had a series of miracles occurring. Then during the exile in Babylon, when the few who were left were in serious jeopardy, you had another series going on. And then foremost, you had a very different series of miracles happening through Jesus Christ, things which he carried out. When I say different, to me they are very positive miracles, and the purpose is to bring people to him. Those people who weren't listening to his words the way he wanted them to, he was using miracles to convince, or to at least get their attention. Again, I feel all those things are not that different from what we see every day. It's just that because we see a plant growing, or we see a baby being born, because we see that kind of thing all the time, we take it for granted. And so it's something that's mundane and routine. But it's not. It's far from that. I had a good laugh today. I got a recent copy of Science News, and in there there's an article on rotary engines in cells. I don't know whether you saw that or you followed this or not, but bacterial cells, for instance, E. coli, Escherichia coli, which is a common intestinal bacterium, has flagella. And these things turn and pull the bacterium through whatever medium it happens to be in. Well, it turns out they have little motors in there that turn the flagella. The flagella are screw-shaped, and as they turn, they literally pull the cell through the soup that it happens to be in. And the person who was talking to the reporter and was quoted made a comment that I had to laugh at, and that was, he said, it's really interesting and exciting what nature has designed here. You know, I had to laugh. You know, he was saying a lot more than he knew, I think. I'm virtually sure of that. You and I would look at this in a very different way. Here's how God has designed it. Here's how God has put things in motion, so that this is how it has happened. In fact, we may as well talk about evolution a little bit while we're on it, on that topic. Evolution has two elements, really, when you look at it. The first is what we call selection. And we've all experienced selection. If you've eaten a hamburger or an apple or something like that, you know all about selection. Because farmers for generations, for eons, have selected the best of their crops, perhaps crossbred them with between another plant, let's say two plants of same species that have nice characteristics, ones that they like, they crossbreed them, they have selected for certain characteristics. That's one element of evolution. In that case, the farmer is doing it. We don't call that natural selection. When it happens in nature, we say it's natural selection. You know, in other words, certain species or types or organisms are being selected either positively or negatively, either because they are able to breed better and more plentifully, they become the dominant organisms around, or negatively, they die off. They're doing something wrong, you know, and they're killed off so they don't reproduce. That's the one side of evolution. The other side is, how are we going to get these variable characteristics? You know, where are they going to come from? They have to come from somewhere. Stephen Jay Gould, who you may be aware of, would say that these come from random mutations. What is a random mutation? Well, the random mutation, he means, is changes in the genetic material in the organism. Let's say the plant or the fish. That's what he's talking about. We, of course, put a different interpretation on that because we know how and why it's happening, because God has planned things in that way. So I have no trouble with evolution as long as I can define it my way, see, because I know how things are going about. Yes, Bob?
Are Christians being selected
for faith and for meekness and for poverty of spirit?
We are told that we are, the Bible says we are selected. God selects us, right? I don't know why and how. I'm glad he selected me and you and everyone here. I can't answer that question. That's a good one. Perry, you want to take a shot at that?
That would get into a very serious discussion on election and what have you, which is probably a road that would take too long to go down.
We only have one evening.
Are we looking at two different things, though?
Actually, I think so. Yeah.
Because election is God's choice of us to get saved, which presumably is based on nothing in us. Whereas, say, if you're thinking of sanctification in your selection, your spiritual selection, mm-hmm.
Yes,
and you're saying God is, in some sense, bringing you certain circumstances and such in order for you to develop certain characteristics.
And that Lamarckian kind of evolution.
Right.
That, I think, would be more.
Certainly feels like it sometimes.
I should point out that today there's new things that we know, and that is that probably these genetic variations in natural populations come about in ways that we never thought of before. And one is probably through virus infection. That is, new genetic material can be picked up by an organism by being infected by a virus. It probably happens. It may also happen through bacterial infection also. In fact, one theory of where the mitochondria, which are the kind of the powerhouses of a cell, where they have come from is, in fact, they were bacterial infection of some larger plant cell at one time. You can make a pretty good case for that. Just interesting tidbit I would throw in. I'd also like to point out that Darwin himself would not agree with the theory of evolution as it presented today. Darwin did believe in the inheritance of acquired characters, as opposed to what came after him. Darwin felt that, let's say, if you had a fish, they could grow in, let's say, salt water between 3.5% and 4.5% of salt. If you had a fish like that, and it was, you kept putting it into more and more salty water, that fish, that individual fish, would be able to acclimate itself to this changing environment, this increasingly salty water, and that it would pass on that information to its offspring. Okay. And that is the essence of a Lamarckism, by the way. Franz Haeckel and people like that supported that also in the late 1800s. So Darwin himself would not agree with evolution as it's described today. In fact, somewhere I read that Darwin, in his last days, did in the end reject much of what he had said earlier and said probably that God was behind all of this. He was the son of a preacher, as you're probably aware. So he certainly had a theological background as a child. He's an interesting character. It's amazing he survived as long as he did, because when he went to South America and the Galapagos Islands, all those places, the man came down with every disease you could think of. I mean, he got Chagas disease and malaria and dengue and everything. He got just about everything. In fact, he was very ill for much of his life after that. It's amazing that he survived as long as he did. Very interesting character. So that is evolution. I have no trouble saying I believe evolution happens, but I've got my own definition as to why. So, that God has set things up and in happening in a certain manner. But I have no trouble with that, because I use my own definition. And you will, by the way, you will find in among scientists who study evolution, each of them has certain variations of their own definition of what they're talking about when they talk about evolution. So don't get all hung up on evolution. It is really not a big deal. It really isn't. Okay, so science, evolution. Jay Gould and people like that today say there's no need for a God, that they can define, that they can describe how things happen without a God. And that can be argued either way, and it's not provable either way. We simply know, because we have faith. So, his position is not supportable either, by the way. It really is not, because he can't explain everything, although he claims to be able to do so. He really cannot explain much of what happens. Don't let scientists tell you that they know all about their field or that their field is well described at this point. That is never true. I move through many different industries and many different fields by virtue of what I do. And Perry's got into this a bit now also. And what we find as we do this is that no field really has a very firm foundation. There are serious theoretical and practical holes in every field. And I don't care whether you're talking about medicine or biology or particle sizing or whatever. There are always serious problems. And fortunately, science, in the pure sense, recognizes that and will keep changing. It will keep changing as it finds these problems and is able to correct them, it will keep changing. And some people have trouble with that, you know, that a Jay Gould changes his mind and says something later that he did not say before. But that is the nature of science. If you can't live with change, you don't belong in science because things are ever-changing, most definitely. We know that there are amino acids free in space, for instance. We know that's true. They are on meteors, that sort of thing. But it begs the question, okay, if there was life or something in space that was able to form life and it ended up here, well, then how did it get out there? See? So it doesn't answer, from an earthbound perspective, it may answer the question, but from looking at the entire universe and trying to decide where and how things came from, it doesn't answer anything. So I don't really care what they say. I mean, it's of interest, but it doesn't really affect the answer in the end. It doesn't matter. Yes, that comes up periodically. You'll also see that life has been created in a test tube. That's nonsense. Yes, we can create amino acids by putting an ammonia brew in there with some sparks and that kind of thing. That was done in the 50s. But that's not life. By the way, I don't rule out the possibility that we may be able to create life in a test tube. That's entirely possible. That's entirely possible. Once we find enough rules by which God does things, we may be able to do that. That's possible. I don't like the thought of it too much because generally we don't do very well at handling the information that we gain. You know, when you look at the atom and many, many, many other things, we tend to misuse our knowledge. I don't look forward to that one too much. Yes?
In regards to the cloning, what exactly did they clone?
There have been some complex proteins that have been able to duplicate themselves or at least come close to doing that, at least for a few cycles. That sort of thing has been done. That was done years ago. I think there was a French worker who did that in the mid-60s using, I think it was basically various types of oils and water and surfactants added to them where you could get different micelles, which are small droplets within another liquid, duplicating themselves. You know, somehow they were drawing out of the slurry of materials the products necessary to make other little droplets. But that wasn't life. You know, and the people at the time didn't claim that it was, but it was an interesting analogy and showed maybe how things could be done to create life. Just kind of an interesting aside there. I'll skip over some of these things so I don't take too long. I've already used more time than I wanted to. Let's see. Scientists often make self-serving claims. And probably the worst, if you want to call it scientific field, in that respect, is the medical field. Medical and allied fields. Because they have to deliver a product and charge for it. They have to make us want to buy it. And basically, they have to do a selling job on us. So, and that is part of the way we deliver medicine, for better or for worse. So in dealing with Lyme disease, the problems with Lyme disease, in dealing with AIDS and so many other problems, social problems that we have, that gets in the way. The claims that are made that cannot be substantiated seriously get in the way of dealing with problems. I'll come back to that again when we watch the slides in a couple of minutes. I'd like to talk about creation itself for a minute. As far as plants and animals and the things that we see about us, the ancients certainly had a very good handle on what was out there. And that makes sense because they lived or died by what they knew about what was around them. But Moses certainly had a very clear idea of when he was laying out the laws of fishes, fins, scales, hooves, ruminates, non-ruminates, that kind of thing. Certainly had very clear concepts of that. Solomon, who's alleged is to be, according to the Bible, is the most intelligent, I guess you'd say in today's lingo, intelligent man who's ever lived or ever will, is described as laying out plants and animals, he lays them out in a phylogenetic order, as a biologist would call it today. Presumably he knew a great deal more than we see in the Bible, because they were not intending that to be a biology text. It would have been very interesting to know exactly what he did talk about to Queen of Sheba and people like that. It would be very interesting to know that. But so those people had a very firm handle on creation and how it was put together and how it interacted. They knew that quite well. And as we look at the creation story in the Bible, I think there are several things we can say that give us a better insight on where we fit in. First of all, in the creation story, we see that God existed alone. before there was anything else, either spiritual or physical. That is, he alone existed. We see that we owe God worship, we owe God service. You know, he was making that demand, that request, and certainly as our creator, we owe that to him. God reveals his nature to us, at least in part, through the creative act of creating the universe. We learn a great deal about him in the way he does things and the way he attacks problems. And I think the fourth thing I'd like to point out is to accept Jesus Christ as our Savior, to accept what God has done. We need a firm understanding of the fact that he is our creator in addition to being our Savior. I know I personally tend to overlook that. That slips past me all the time. But he's our creator too. It's important to remember that, I feel. There are a number of other things I could go over here. I do want to blitz through these slides that I have with respect to Lyme disease. I guess to summarize what we've talked about here right now, there is no conflict between science and religion. There really is not. A Christian who is a scientist, in every case that I know, has no problem dealing with both. There really is no conflict. Don't let people tell you that there are. The only time we see conflicts is when one side or the other, or both, wants there to be one, in my opinion. That's what I see. Does anybody have trouble with that statement? Let me say that what this world needs today is people with dreams, people with vision. We read in Proverbs that without dreams, the people perish. We see in Joel, and again in Acts, proclaiming God's message, your young men will see visions, your old men will have dreams. This country, this world desperately needs those things. We need a dream again. We know what that dream should be. People need Jesus Christ. They need to help other people. These are elements that are missing terribly, terribly in this world today. All of us can do things about that, both as individuals, as members of our church, as members of a school. There's a lot that we can do. So I want to exhort you to witness for Jesus Christ, again, as a church member, as an individual, and bring backsliders back into the fold, back into the body of Christ. When we do our evangelism, we're going to do our evangelism program in January and February this coming year. We will dial up about 20,000 households. 20,000. And out of that 20,000, we will get probably between 100 and 200 people who either have gone away from Jesus Christ or have never known him. And we'll do that over the telephone. It works beautifully. And it works today because people don't want you to come to their door. They're afraid if you come to their door. But they will answer the phone and they will talk to you. And out of 20,000 phone calls, I would be surprised if we get more than 50 negative responses. 50 out of 20,000. There is a crying need out there. People know it. People know it. And they will listen. The people who have problems, the people who realize that they don't have their act together, that you know something major has changed in their lives, those people will listen. They will listen. Tremendous opportunity. Telephone is a wonderful tool. Wonderful. Let me run through these slides and talk about Lyme disease for a minute. Because in Lyme disease, we see all these things we talked about, the anti-science, not wanting to get involved, the medical establishment not being... switch it back to that area. Right by the cord, Don. Sure the cord goes in the back. Excellent. We see all of these problems surfacing in this one disease. Now, it happens in lots of others. Babesiosis, AIDS, Ehrlichiosis. There are all kinds of diseases in the United States that most people don't hear about unless they work in this industry. But in this one, it's... everything shows up. Lyme disease was named after the town of Lyme, Connecticut, because that's where a housewife got fed up with the fact that she saw, I think it was about 30 or 40 children in her town with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, the doctors said, and they were more all the time. This was only a small town. So she harassed the state, and then she harassed Yale University to find out what in the world was going on, and eventually they did. So Lyme, Connecticut is what gave the disease its name. It is worldwide. It is most prevalent in the temperate parts of the world, but there is no country that does not have Lyme disease. Let me give you a slide. This is a spirochete, a bacterium that happens to be in spiral shape, so it's called a spirochete. It's about 30 30 to 40 microns long. That is huge for a bacterium. That's the size of some small roundworms. It infects cells and plants and things like that. This thing is huge as bacteria go. In fact, if it weren't for the fact that it's so narrow, you'd be able to see it with your naked eye. You could see the thing. This one is in very good health. I'll show you one in bad health in a minute. Here's some that are tagged with fluorescent antibodies, and you can see them, the squiggly little things there. Here's one that's in bad shape. Notice that it's not tightly coiled, and the outer surface membrane is being released. It sheds that outer surface membrane on a continuing basis. The antibodies that your body produces are against the proteins in that outer surface membrane, but the bacterium keeps shedding them and changing them, so the antibodies don't work. See? That's why people get Lyme disease and don't recover. That's why they can get it as many times as they're infected. This is one tricky bacterium. It's closely related to Treponema pallidum, the bacterium that causes syphilis. And then the symptoms are much the same. Effects on a baby, modes of transmission are very similar. The deer tick, this is a female adult deer tick, which is out right now looking for a host. This is the most common vector of this disease right here in Hatfield, in this area. It's called a deer tick because they mate on deer. That's about the size of a sesame seed, by the way. Here's a male and a female. Here's a scanning electron micrograph. You can see the barbed hypostome. That's what it punches through your skin and then draws blood out and regurgitates some of its own anticoagulants and anesthetics. You will not feel a tick bite usually. It won't hurt and it won't itch because it injects you with anesthesia. It's pretty rare to feel a tick bite. That was an adult. This is a larva. Notice only six legs on a larva. The nymphs and the adults have eight legs, which like most arachnids do. Here's a set. A larva, that's about the quarter of the size of a period on a page, almost clear as you can see. You need to know what to look for. They're tough to see. This is a nymph. That's about the size of a period on a page, adult male and adult female. Any of them can infect you, but the nymphs are usually the most infectious. This is a different tick that's found in New Jersey along the coast. Notice a white dot on the back. That also can transmit the disease. Here's the standard dog tick that we all know about, that we're accustomed to seeing. And here are the deer ticks over here. Much smaller, as you can see. Much, much smaller. There's a nymph on somebody's skin, the fingernail for comparison. That one did infect the person with the disease. You have to know what to look for. That's the New Jersey tick. Again, notice the white spot on there. If you're along the coast, you may see that one. This is the type of critter that is that harbors the disease itself, disease bacteria. This is a mouse, white-footed mouse. Notice the ticks all over the ear, around the eyes. Typical mouse around here, when I trap them, has between 2 and 4 dozen ticks on it. Most of the mice here are infectious. Most of the small birds are infectious. About half the ticks are infectious here. For some reason, not all of them get infected. This is where, the ticks mate. Of course, the deer run around all over the countryside and drop the ticks off after the ticks have taken their blood meal, so they're spreading them everywhere. Birds do the same thing because birds fly about and drop them off. Deer have become very tame in the area all along the East Coast, so they bring the ticks right up to your backyard. I think that's an opossum. You can see a whole row of engorged ticks there. Here's a little white-footed mouse next to somebody's refrigerator. They come right into houses, bring disease, bring the ticks in with them. This is a very young one. It's gray. Adult mice are brown, like this one. Again, you may be able to see some of the ticks behind the ears on that one. Lyme disease tends to be an upscale disease. Or I should say it's a democratic disease. You can find it anywhere. But often you find it where it's more expensive housing, where people are living right on the edge of the woods, or maybe even in the woods, where there are lots of animals, lots of birds. Many people get Lyme disease right in their own backyards. Deer love mixed habitat. Here you have young woods and fields. Deer love that kind of setting. Of course, we have lots of that around here, on the edges of the developments especially. Here's a typical house built right in smack into the woods. There's a researcher up here collecting ticks. As I said, upscale areas tend to be where we find this disease most commonly. Upscale houses, usually, but not always. Sometimes you get a house like this, and right on the edge of the woods. The ticks normally and the mice are in the shaded areas. Deer ticks dry out pretty quickly, so they will die if they're out here in the sun, usually. Not always, but usually. Wood piles are great for small birds, mice, small mammals, you know, chipmunks, squirrels. So infected ticks are very commonly found in around rotting wood piles, old stone fences, places like that. In a site like this, there would probably be no ticks out here. They would be in the shaded areas. Good point here. This is the hunt. You know, people who ride horses and move them across the country take deer ticks and the disease with them. This was shot in Massachusetts. So some of the horses from this site went to California. Others went down to Florida and took the infected ticks with them. And that's very common. Here's what a well-dressed tick picker wears. Boots, clothing that's light in color so you can see the ticks walking on you. They are visible. Once you know what to look for, you can see them. Here's a fellow flagging for ticks. What to do to avoid the disease? Avoid heavily tick-infested areas. That's not quite focused, is it? What happened to the autofocus? Avoid heavily tick-infested areas. Control the vegetation and rake high-use areas, and that's to expose the ticks to sunlight so they dry out. They do die easily. In fact, they're tough to keep alive when I collect them, which is hard to believe. Hard to believe. You can use pesticides work. Many, many pesticides will kill ticks. They're actually rather easy to kill, and there are many safe pesticides as long as they're properly applied. There's nothing wrong with pesticides as long as they're used wisely. Nothing at all. We need them. Check and control ticks on pets. Pets very often bring ticks into houses, and often they are infected. Here's a good way to dress if you're going out in the woods where you know there's likely to be ticks. White socks, light-colored clothing, stuff the pant legs into the socks. Ticks like to walk upward. So by layering the clothing in this manner, the tick has to get all the way up to the person's collar of their shirt before they can get to skin. So if you're walking with someone else, you check one another every 5 or 10 minutes for ticks, which is what we do when we're out collecting, you're pretty safe. You really are. And use repellents. Repellents do work. Not 100%, but pretty close to it. Permanone is an insecticide which is labeled for spraying on your clothing. So you can spray that on the white-colored pants, socks. This kills a tick in about 5 minutes. I've checked it. Check children. This is tough. I know one lady who lives down in Lower Moreland who refuses to use insecticides, and she picks over her three daughters every night. Every night. She lives right in the middle of the woods. There are ticks everywhere. I've even taken ticks in July in 100-degree temperatures out in the middle of a lawn. There's just so many animals and birds running around and flying about with ticks on them, falling off, but there are always some, even out in the middle of the lawn. So check the children over, check pets over. Dogs are really tough, especially long-haired dogs. Dogs can be dipped in the permethrin insecticide, by the way. Any vet does that. You can even buy it and do it yourself. It's a reasonably safe product. It's, I think, 2.5 times safer than vanilla flavoring. Which, really, it is. That doesn't mean it's perfectly safe. It just means you shouldn't be drinking vanilla flavoring straight, you know. To get ticks off of yourself, the easiest way to do it is use something that would remove lint from your clothing, either Scotch tape or one of these Velcro-type lint removers. Works great. As far as removing a tick, use forceps. If the tick has embedded itself in you, use forceps, grab it by the head. In fact, take some of your skin with it so that you know you get the whole thing. Grab close to the skin, pull slowly and steadily. The tick cannot let go. Remember the barbs on the hypostome, the thing that dries in your skin? It cannot let go. It not only has those barbs, if it's been on here an hour or two, it also secretes a glue. The tick can't let go. You have got to tear it free. Do not, as I said in Part D, avoid squeezing the tick. Don't squeeze the body of the tick. If you do, it will act like a hypodermic syringe and inject its gut contents into you, and it's almost a guaranteed infection. Then clean the wound with an antiseptic. Borrelia burgdorferi, the bacterium that causes Lyme, is very easy to kill, extremely easy to kill. Alcohol, any antiseptic will kill it. There are many diseases carried by ticks in North America. Here are a few of them: Rocky Mountain spotted fever, Lyme disease, Ehrlichiosis, babesiosis. In fact, maybe I'll take 1 minute to describe a couple of these. Babesiosis is a new malaria-type disease that's coming down the North Atlantic coast. So far, it's down to Long Island. It's been there about 5 years. It hasn't moved south so far. Hopefully, it's going to stay there. it kills about 10% of the people, between 5 and 10% of the people who get it, and there is no cure for it. What else on here? Well, tularemia, that's rabbit fever. That's been in this area for years. Right now it's at a high level. That goes up and down. When I lived in Pittsburgh, it was everywhere. Virtually all the rabbits in the woods had tularemia. It's easy to tell because you cut them open, look at the liver, and there's white spots on the liver when they get tularemia. Q fever, Colorado tick fever, which you may have heard of. Powassan encephalitis is a type of encephalitis from Russia. It's come across from Asia, across the top of the world, has come down through Canada, and is in it's in upper New York State, although it's not come down here yet so far. Tick paralysis, that happens here. Tick paralysis is usually caused by the common dog tick, Dermacentor variabilis, so the one that we, you know, as kids 30, 50 years ago, we knew as ticks. It usually happens in kids. If a tick bites the child and is on there for a few days, it will paralyze the child. Fortunately, it's reversible. If it's pulled off, the paralysis goes away within a few minutes. So the problem comes in not knowing the tick's there. But once it's found, that can be cured. Lyme disease, these Borrelia bacteria can infect any part of the body virtually. And it becomes extremely confusing for a physician or anybody else trying to look at the disease because the symptoms are going to depend upon where the bacteria happen to have entered and what tissues they happen to have infected. It can get into the brain almost immediately, which is why I tell people when they call me about Lyme disease, if you have been bitten by a tick, that is, if the tick has broken the skin, go to your doctor and get antibiotics immediately, not tomorrow, today, and take them for 6 to 8 weeks. At this stage, it's easy to kill these bacteria. Even penicillin will usually do it, or doxycycline, which is one of the cheap tetracyclines, will kill it. For under $100, you get the visit and enough antibiotic to get rid to kill the bacteria. That is very cheap insurance. The typical difficult Lyme disease case costs about $62,000 to cure, we think. It may be more than that. In a child, it's a lot more. In a child, it's about $130,000. And the reason is that the child has to be tutored, typically for about 3 years, because the child can't go to school. And of course, school districts are responsible for providing, I think it's called homebound education. So the school districts who end up with, let's say, 100 or 200 children, such as in Monmouth County and Ocean County, New Jersey, are screaming. Their budgets are getting killed by these homebound tuition or fees that they have to pay in order to tutor the children with Lyme disease. This is a devastating disease, absolutely devastating. Here's a list of symptoms that can occur. And if you take a quick look at this, you'll see almost any symptom you could think of from a virus or whatever could be Lyme, or vice versa. It's impossible to say for sure. Here's a series. About 40% of the people get a rash when they're bitten by a tick and get Lyme disease. Here's some sample rashes. Typically, they're about 3 or 4 inches across, something like that. That was a classic bullseye rash, by the way, that last one. This color's a little off. It's usually not quite that red. As you can see, they're often of quite some size. There's another one on a leg, under the back of someone's back on the arm. Sometimes the tissue does die and actually fall off. There's necrosis of the tissue, and it looks like that. There's one on the back again, above a breast. It brings up a good point. Ticks tend to bite where there's a cryptic area, a spot where they can hide between clothing and skin, for instance, in an armpit, a waistline, in this case, the top of the bra. That's where they tend to bite. Many of them are very ugly. Now, here's one that's kind of an orange color. It's not so pronounced. There's one on a child's buttocks. It's kind of an unusual shape. But apparently, that's where the top of the underwear was. And that's where the tick bit. Very mild one on the inside of the leg here. This is a case in Texas. Now, how in the world this person didn't know that it was bitten by so many ticks is beyond me, but this does happen. Once in a while, you'll get this from a single tick bite. The rash does not necessarily occur just where the tick bit the person. It can be many different areas. Just above the waistline there. Hairline. Very faint one on the inside of the knee here. You just barely see it. Now, this is a lymphocytoma caused by Borrelia. In other words, the lymphatic system has been clogged by the bacteria and encysted by the body. And it causes this kind of thing. This is very common in Europe, not too common here. These are the hands of a 39-year-old woman. She's 39 years old. This is what Lyme disease can do to the skin. This did resolve after she was treated for, I think, for like 2 or 3 years with antibiotics. That did finally go away, and her skin became normal again. In this area, if you see somebody with Bell's palsy, and that's what this woman has, this side of her face is not paralyzed. This side is. Cranial nerves, nerve 7 or 8, I think it is, have been attacked by the Borrelia burgdorferi, and she has lost control of this side of her face. That's, you know, she can't smile, and she can't close this eye. That's called Bell's palsy. In this area, if you see some of Bell's palsy, the odds are very high that they have infection with Lyme disease. Very high. Here's a little boy. His mother had Lyme disease when he was in utero. Here he looks fine. Here he is a week later. You can see it's beginning to affect the nerves and it's coming off his spine and it's into his brain. Here's an eye. That's a shot through the lens of the back of somebody's eye. You can get a rash in the eye, in the retina. Here's an athlete who obviously is not an athlete now. She was infected with Lyme. This is the spleen of a fetus that aborted as a result of Lyme. You can see the spirochetes in here, in the spleen cells, mixed in with the spleen cells. Here's a little boy about a year later. This is another child with Lyme. He died. This little boy did not. He lived to be about 5. Here's a cat with Bell's palsy. This side is paralyzed. The cat can't close the eye and can't bend the ear. On this side, it can. Here's a dog with the arthritic symptoms from Lyme. You really can't see it, but from the way the dog is standing, you can tell that he looks like a very old dog, but that's not the case. And here's a horse. Horses and cows are very seriously affected by Lyme. Most domestic animals are. Apparently, they've not been exposed to it for many generations, as have wild animals. But you can see that the joints are badly swollen. I'm told that in Connecticut, you can tell which fields are infected with Lyme, that is, which fields have ticks that are infected with Lyme, just by looking at the cows, because the joints on the cows are swollen. Milk does have Lyme bacteria in it. Meat has Lyme bacteria in it. So far, we don't know of any cases that are transmitted by meat. We know of cases that were transmitted by milk, usually mother's milk, because it's not pasteurized. We don't think that people have been infected from pasteurized milk. We don't think people have been affected from cooked meat. We're not sure of that yet. This is a devastating disease. Can affect any part of the body. Occasionally kills, but not too often. Usually it disables. If it's not treated, I'd say within a year, very often the disability is permanent. There have been numerous cases of supposed senile dementia that, in fact, were Lyme disease. There was a recent case over here in New Jersey just last year. And a very, very sharp family member decided that this couldn't be dementia and had the person treated with antibiotics. And lo and behold, he recovered. This man was in a nursing home. He had been committed there and didn't even know who he was. And today he's out driving around. You know, amazing, amazing. So that is Lyme disease, devastating disease. I hope you got some idea of the severity of it, what the ticks look like. But bear in mind, it can be transmitted other ways, but most definitely, sexually, through blood, through urine, sputum, milk. Yes?
Did you say there was some way that the society could be dealing with it if it wasn't?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear all the question.
You said there was some way that the society could be dealing with it, but it doesn't.
Yes, yes, yes. Many people get this kind of thing in their backyards from the ticks. It would be very simple to treat the backyards with an insecticide. People are treating backyards with insecticides to kill soil grubs, but here we do not have a tradition of protecting ourselves against disease vectors.
Does thursday granules or diastole granules work?
Yes.
Are they sufficient?
Yes. Two or three times a year. Do it in, as soon as it's, you would say it's spring, as soon as it's starting to warm up.
At what temperature do these sugars become active? Are they active now?
Yes. Anything above freezing. Yes. Yes. They're much slower. For instance, if you go out in a summer morning and scoop some up off the leaf litter and put it on your skin, and it's, let's say, 55 degrees outside, for a minute or so, they'll just sit there. But then once they warm up, they take off. They move very quickly. They do slow down greatly when it's cold out. But as long as it's above freezing, they can move.
And so when a freeze comes, they're inactive, but then as soon as it gets above it, they're...
Exactly, exactly. So you get a warm winter afternoon, and they will start to move around on the leaf litter.
Even now, it's profitable to treat the grounds.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been better to do it in, let's say, October, Yes. If you live in an area where you have deer in your backyard, you have leaf litter on the ground, you have small mammals and birds around, let's say rotting wood piles, old stone fences, you know, the idyllic scene. If you have that kind of setting, yes, definitely you should be treating the grass where people are going to be with insecticides. No question about it, yes.
Are there accurate diagnostics?
No. There is no good test for Lyme disease, period. The best tests available today are not science, they're art. They can't be duplicated on a repeatable basis. There have been round robins done through the various labs in the country, and the results are appalling. Appalling. The typical $35 test that your doctor will have done is about 40% accurate. And by that I mean if you take 100 people who you are absolutely sure have Lyme disease because they were bitten by a tick and they had their rash and they had all the symptoms and all that kind of thing, and you test them with the typical ELISA test, enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay test, about 40% of the time it will say that they have Lyme disease. That's a dreadful test. You can flip a coin and do better, which is why the diagnosis is really based on clinical symptoms. You know, is the person from an area that has Lyme disease in it? Is the person outdoors? Did they have a rash? Do they have other symptoms that just can't be explained, that don't make sense? You know, and under that kind of condition, you better throw everything at it in terms of antibiotic treatment. If you can kill the bacteria within the first few weeks or months, we think you can cure it. We think. If the person goes 2, 3, 4, 5 years without treatment, the odds are you're not going to cure it. The best you can do is fight a holding action. That's the best you can do. Which is true also of syphilis. Same kind of situation. If you have a child who was born with syphilis, and they show no symptoms after they're born, what typically happens is at age 30 to 40, they will suddenly break out with all the symptoms of syphilis. You know, disastrous symptoms. It's in the brain. It's in the liver, spleen, all parts of the body. There's a reasonable chance that the Lyme bacteria can do the same thing. We haven't been watching this disease long enough to know if that happens. We do know that of those original 37 or 39 kids in Lyme, Connecticut, that the Polly Murray and the other mothers saw those patients. Those kids were treated with, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks of antibiotics, penicillin. They were declared cured by the attending physicians. 1/3 of those people are now permanently disabled. Of course, they're adults now. They're permanently disabled. See? This has been what? It's been 20 years since then. Yes?
Are they working on any kind of immunity?
Yes. But bear in mind, we've been working for over 100 years on a vaccine for syphilis. And the problem is the fact that those outer surface membrane proteins keep changing and the bacteria keep shedding pieces. They're called blebs, pieces, little pockets of the outer surface proteins. They keep releasing those. So the immune system goes to work and makes antibodies against the wrong thing. See? That's the problem. There are very few proteins on that bacterium that are conservative, that is, that occur in all individuals. There may not be any. We're not sure yet. A lot of people are trying.
It's amazing. The environment, the pastoral, wonderful outdoor area has now become the dangerous place to go.
It always was. It always was.
But we didn't know it.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, and that's, people from the northern part of the United States are blessed. You know, we are in a climate that is about as good as it gets anywhere on the face of the earth with respect to disease. I mean, once you got north of the Mason-Dixon line, you didn't have hookworm, and once they cleaned up the swamps around Philadelphia, you didn't have malaria, and you didn't have yellow fever and all these other problems. Once we got sewage plants, we didn't have typhoid-type infections, and now all of a sudden, the jungle out there has started to move in on us. And in part, it's our own fault. We have allowed the farmlands to grow up again, see? The woodlands, young woods are growing up. They are perfect habitat for all kinds of little fuzzy and furry things. And those things are kind of a highway, and also for deer. Those are a highway for disease and disease vectors to come back into the area. And that's exactly what's happening. See? Borrelia has probably been here for thousands of years, the Lyme bacterium. But there are more deer, for instance, in the state of Pennsylvania now than ever before. Ever.
Right in Philadelphia, on the border of Philadelphia, there's a Schofield Valley Nature Center.
That is probably the worst part in the state of Pennsylvania. There's more Lyme disease contracted in that site probably than any other place in the state of Pennsylvania.
Well, I used to go through there all the time last year, and we didn't go there. It seemed to be okay now, but not born there anymore.
Right. The Pennypack stream watershed going down from Montgomery County down through Philadelphia to the Delaware River also. We take ticks out of there all the time. They're virtually always infected. All the way down to within sight of the Delaware River. Thank you. God bless you. Have a nice holiday.